Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. You know, yesterday we were talking with Brett Lloyd, Response Bureau Chief for the Montana Disaster and Emergency Services Agency. Again, we're going kind of back on the ground. We've seen those videos of the flooding up in Lincoln County, but not only Lincoln County, Sanders, Flathead County, other areas too. And we've encountered flooding in Montana, right? That's one of our, one of those things we get to live with around here too. What happens to the roadways and the bridges? We saw them just downed, right? So how does the transportation department get in there, assess the damage to the roads? And it's not just where they see it. They have to assess the entire roadway, so to speak, where they feel that there might have been some storm damage. You got to keep you safe and then plan for repairs. It's a long process, I imagine. We'll find out more. Chris Dorrington, yes, that Chris Dorrington, director of the Montana Department of Transportation, on the program today. A lot of roadways, some were closed. We saw some bridges that were damaged and down. And you just got to think, man, what's it take to get those things repaired again? It's a process. And, man, you know, and I'm looking at some statistics about how much we use our roadways, $54 billion of commerce every day. This is across the U.S., so 53 million tons of freight every day, which is valued at $54 billion. Very, very vital. Chris Dorrington knows that. He is our director of the Montana Department of Transportation. Been serving in that role for a little time. Had previously served with the DOT, and then we've known him as well as he went to work for, Department of Environmental Quality, right? The DEQ. Thank you. Yeah. I get lost in all those acronyms. How you doing, Christopher?
I'm so well. Thanks, Tom, for having me on today.
Thanks for coming on today. Appreciate that. You guys have probably, you know, evaluated a lot of the damage already, but let's start there. Let's start, you know, what's the first thing you guys do when you hear like the bridge is out?
Well, the first thing is to assess the safe travel for our citizens, and then, you know, it transitions pretty quickly into either road closures, in which we have to communicate with all of the stakeholders that either travel or use the roads, or, you know, the local entities are trying to do our very best to help them. It's surprising, Tom, that, you know, not everybody knows whose bridge is whose until we know ours, of course, but the citizen might not realize that sometimes a bridge is owned by a local entity, a city or a county, or even the federal government, the Forest Service owns a bunch of highway and bridges, and then we have ours. And so when the emergency hits, no one cares about whose is whose.
Right.
We just make sure people are safe, and then we sort out and begin the assessment of the structures and the roadway to make sure people are safe, not only for the short term, but the long term.
And there's an evaluation. Again, go to the Department of Transportation, because if you're looking for up-to-date stuff, you guys keep your website up to date on those things. That's one of the main purposes, mdt.mt.gov. What's your assessment of the damage? How widespread is it? How extensive is it?
Yeah, it's, you know, the flooding up there, what a crazy event. An atmospheric river hit the northwest of the United States, and we were not left unscathed. So MDT has two structures that are in pretty poor shape on secondary 482 and secondary 471. Secondary 471 south, 482 is right near Libby. It actually, the roadway, the approach to the bridge over Libby Creek was completely washed away. There's 200 feet of roadway missing due to the floodwaters. And similar on secondary 471, we had an approach that was washed away. And now what we did, you know, just so thankful for all of the people that work at the department, incredible teamwork. So you have maintenance professionals, you have bridge and structure professionals, you have GIS and technology professionals all coming together, working with the locals, working with Montana DES. You know, it sounds like you had them on yesterday. Mm-hmm. Soon to be working with FEMA, and then working with all our local partners and stakeholders. And my gosh, we could also give a shout out to the private contractors who have already stepped up and said, we will help. Let us know what you need. And so that whole team comes together as soon as the waters have recede, and they have. We're looking at the structures to make sure they're safe now and into the future, and then starting to design options for how to get those roads and bridges back open.
What does that analysis look like? I mean, how do you try to find trouble in the roadway after such an event like that? The ground is saturated, and, right. and you don't always, the problems may not always present themselves. How do you right. get ahead of that?
It's a great question, Tom. The first is that our professionals know what to look for. So, and there's some real subtleties, but it's not going to surprise anyone. On a structure, if things don't line up vertically, horizontally, and then you begin looking into the river, making certain the bridge abutments and the piers are both plumb and stable, and then looking for what we call scour, which is a washout at the base of any support structure for a bridge. What can happen in that scour event is that all or some of the material could be removed from the bottom of structure, and then that is not a safe, stable structure. And so then we close the road, and we begin designing an improvement. Our bridge engineers and our maintenance folks are absolutely excellent at assessing whether a road or bridge is safe. They look at all the elements, it's not just the surface, but all the structural support, and they get down there, they get right into the thick of it, and then make an assessment based on the characteristics that they see and how it should be performing.
You know, you're a mechanical engineer, Gonzaga University, and you've got your master's from George Mason University in transportation policy. So you can visualize what the bottom of a bridge looks like, so to speak. Maybe correct. tell us, maybe there's technological advancements nowadays from when these bridges were built 40, 50, 60 years ago. And we've talked about infrastructure and our backlog of that. And, you know, that is something that's, you know, right in front of you always. But tell us, what makes a good bridge 2025?
Sure. First, starting in the approach of the abutments, the structure in which the structural elements on the end of the bridge, and then you have the bridge itself. You have stringers, you have beams that extend, and then you have surfacing, and you have rail to keep cars and pedestrians up on the bridge and not able to fall off. But the what is interesting, Tom, and your question's a good one, you remember our prior conversation, many of these bridges across Montana have timber elements. If you think way back in the day, between 1930 and 1940, there were about 1,200 timber bridges built in Montana. And many of them are still here. Many of those are not able to carry the heavy loads that we have today. If you think of the size of a truck in 1920 and 30 and 40 and the size of a F-250, F-350 today, or even the UPS and FedEx vans, I mean, they're one-ton or two-ton vans. They are not capable of the structures are not capable of holding some of those loads. And so that's why one of the critical parts of what we do before we close a structure is load post a bridge. People do not love that, I stress it's for the safety of the traveling public, and so that we don't lose the structure prematurely before a fix is ready and put in place.
Yeah, and maybe go into that too. Analyzing these roads now take us. Maybe we're not ready to go to the repair portion of the interview yet, but I'm curious as to how you implement these best practices with a bridge that was built, and there's a number of them like that, but there's also other bridges that are not timber related. How do you implement correct. Best practices nowadays with the existing infrastructure without tearing it all down if you have to?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. You know, probably in your area, Tom, you watch the Yellowstone structure replacement. So We had one structure, it became too long, and those are complicated builds, also very expensive, and I think in the $70 million range to replace a very large two structures over the Yellowstone River. But if you think about that, you know, we're not talking about timber elements in that bridge, of course. We're talking about concrete and steel, both very expensive. We've seen really high inflation in those areas as the United States federal government has put a lot of money into infrastructure investment. But also, you have to assess what it needs to carry. And on an interstate bridge, especially in that Billings area, you have a lot of traffic. You have a lot of truck traffic. And so our professionals assess what is the structure going in, what do we need out of that for the next 50 years, and that we back it back to today, and we design a bridge that's going to stand up both to the weather and the weight, and really support what we anticipate is in traffic growth, truck traffic growth over the course of the future 25, 50 years.
Chris Dorrington is with us here, Montana Department of Transportation Director as well, 24,000 lane miles across our state of Montana. So there's a lot of roadway to think about. I'm going to peel down into this, a farm-to-market bridge up in Lincoln County again. Because, you know, we see that, and you obviously saw the approach fall away, which I think led to the rest of the destruction of at least that part of the bridge. I mean, so visualizing that, take us into day one of assessing that, and how much of that bridge will you be kind of compelled to keep in place for financial reasons? I mean, provided that you meet your safety protocols.
That's right. No, it's a great question, because as we assess that, it's like, you know, there are multiple ways to solve that problem. Many people have seen the pictures. There's a large, you know, there's 200 feet missing of the bridge approach. The structure itself is fairly good. I don't want to say it's perfect yet, because we'll have a little bit of ongoing assessment. But there are a couple options. You know, we could rebuild the approach right to the existing structure. That would require rechanneling some of the river, which of course necessitates us working with the natural resource professionals to make sure we do that well, protect the waterway, the fishery that it is. And another option that we're assessing is just putting a new bridge span from the existing structure onto up to the approach of where it's all washed away. And, of course, we'd reconstruct that in order to have a stable connection. But as you begin assessing the options, you then say, well, if we put a brand new bridge span and attach it to a very old bridge span, are we using the money wisely? Yeah. Is this the best solution? And that's where we're trying to do the very best by saying, what is needed now? What is going to be needed in the future? If we had another event, would we compromise ourselves and the solution we put forth? And then, Tom, we have to follow the rules for the emergency money that's coming in. As you might imagine, emergency funding is not designed to increase the amount of infrastructure you have. It's mostly aimed at replacing what you have. And so we have to also abide by those rules.
The U.S. road network faces a $684 billion funding gap over the next decade. I think we have noted that our spending needs to be redirected to things, in my mind, the government ought to be paying for, and good infrastructure is part of that. We're with Montana's Chris Dorrington, Montana Department of Transportation Director. And Chris served in that role previously, was really lined up for this, mechanical engineering out of Gonzaga, transportation policy masters in operations and logistics. And if I'm George Mason, and man, you're putting those logistics to work here and trying to figure out time and money, and then all the collaboration that goes on when you're looking at roads that were damaged up in Lincoln County, other areas as well, Northwest Montana. So Chris, I'm glad you're prepared for this. It's still a haul. Let's talk about the time and where the money comes from, and also, you know, get into the collaboration of it, because as you noted, state versus federal versus local, there's probably even some tribal concerns in some of these areas too.
You're exactly right, and we focused quite a bit on the Libby area flooding, but last week we had just an unbelievable wind event in the western central part of the state, just incredible destructive winds. And you hit it on the head there. It doesn't matter who you belong to at the time in which your power goes out and your roads go out. In the case of Libby, their water was on a boil order for a little bit while they ensured that the water supply was safe during and after that flood. Infrastructure is a thing that we so often take for granted until it's missing or gone. And my gosh, there's a lot going on, and all of the partners are vital in making that work together.
Where's the money come from? I mean, that's probably question number one.
Sure. Under our normal program, we're a very large beneficiary of the federal dollar for federal highways. We are about, for every dollar we send back in fuel tax, we get $3 back to the state. So we're a donee state. That's a big deal. It's about $500 million a year from the Fed state. And we use it for the normal program. Now, in an emergency...
By the way, Chris, I have no guilt about that, okay?
Me neither.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we got big roads out here. Yeah.
Very excited. Yep. Our population base, you know, having just over 1 million people, we couldn't support the road network without the federal government.
Yeah.
I have no guilt about it either. I think it's awesome. In an emergency, though, Tom, we have access to additional dollars. Now, most people would hear about FEMA, and FEMA comes in. There's the governor jumped right on it, issued a state emergency, and then submitted a request to the federal government. President Trump has to sign that. He did last week. And so we have a designated emergency. FEMA's then activated. They come in, and they bring resources with them, both professionals that know how to handle an emergency and after action, and then also dollars that are available to the locals. For the Department of Transportation, we also have what's called an emergency relief fund, also a federal fund, and we have applied for that. We've received initial concurrence that we have an emergency in that area, and that separate from FEMA, we'll have dollars related to highway rebuild, and that includes bridges as well.
So there's a pile of it there, right, to kind of start with. And then how much are you concerned when, you know, that there's probably a lot of uses for that pile of money? How do you budget that, so to speak, and hit those priorities? I guess it's probably based on that number one priority, public safety.
That's right. And, you know, in terms of saying there's a pile, I never use the word extra. There's more need out there than there is dollars on almost any situation. In emergency, that's certainly the case. What you want to try to do is get the greatest bang for the buck and get people safely moving. In our case, that's what we're trying to do. Our two priorities are that farm-to-market road bridge on Secondary 42 and the secondary 471 structure. Those are state secondaries, so they're more... they're built to a higher standard. They're more likely to be traveled by connecting communities, and so we want to get those open as soon as we can. We also need to do that safely, and that's the most important part.
And time is a consideration, too. And right now you're going to be in not the construction season. So, you know, that's the other season in Montana. Right now we're going to be into the winter season here.
That's right. Winter and construction are the two seasons we have. You're right. I mean, we'll put design on a fast track to replace these. Construction is more challenging for sure when the weather is working against us. We do as much as we can still in inclement weather and we've got a lot of work to do. I mean, design doesn't happen in a day, but certainly we want our roads and bridges open as soon as possible. And you make a good point. I mean, time is of the essence, and boy, is my team on it.
Can some of those regulations, I'm not saying be waived, but how do you fast track some approval processes when time and money is a consideration?
Right. So during an emergency, everybody is called to the table, so they don't get a chance to say, I'm not available for a while. They all come to the table. They're all we're all aligned in our thinking and the design of our solution set has all the voices that say yes and no, and they are immediately ready to go, which is not the norm for a non-emergency status. You might still have a lot of back and forth or interaction. Everybody's at the table to make decisions quickly.
So there's you don't bump into that all that often then, where you're going to see a regulation or a permit holding up processes, or does it happen?
No, it definitely happens. I don't want to shine it on too much. there's still quite a challenge that we'll face. Mostly working with, in our case, mostly working with waterways and trying to make certain that all of the parties that have a say have input right at the beginning, and that we also follow the rules. So you can't. The first thing you want to do is you want to get out there with a big old track hoe, and you want to put dirt back down and get a base set. But you can't do that without making sure the water is protected the entire time. And there's the best practices. Our contractors know what to do. Our teams know what to do. But you also have to make certain that the Army Corps of Engineers or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, our state agencies, the Department of Natural Resources, Fish and Wildlife, that they have eyes on and say, yes, proceed before we put anything, any stick in the ground or any boots in the water.
I got about a little over a minute here too. In terms of the time on it, do you have like a general range? And we can't hold you to that because there's some unknowns there too. But sure. You know, when you look at it, and that bridge is not rebuilt in a year from now, are you saying, well, this project is moving slow, or what's a general timeline where you feel comfortable that those bridges are being replaced on time?
Yeah, the longer term, you have about 2 years on emergency relief funding to get a project put back together. And you think about a major structure being taken out, it'll take a little bit of time to design and put it back in. That would be a long term view of this. I think probably in that 9 to 9 months to 12 month window, everything will be designed, constructed, and reopened is the hope.
Really? Okay. Well, that's faster than I would have imagined, actually.
Well, my people are probably cringing right now as I commit to timelines, but that's, I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. Depending on the options, if we have to design a whole new structure, that will be an extended period of time. And, the more complex the project gets, the more time and money it'll take.
Boy, we think about Montana's roadways, and there's a ton of them, and you can get lost on them, and you probably want to and need to every now and again. We find ourselves on gravel roads across Montana frequently, and that's not a bad thing. Maintaining 1 mile of asphalt can cost as much as 5 times more than maintaining 1 mile of gravel road, and costs are a big consideration here when we look at our interstate system. And originally, in 1956, when President Eisenhower dedicated the interstate highway system, it was 41,000 miles. Now America has over 4.1 million miles of public roadways, including those U.S. routes that are distinct from the interstates as well, 157,000 there. It's a lot of roadways. In Montana, the guy who gets to say yes or no on those is Chris Dorrington. And I know it's a team effort, Chris, and I appreciate that. Director of the Montana Department of Transportation. You couldn't do this without a team, but your team's pretty big. Too, isn't it like I saw somebody report 2,000 employees, but I'm not sure that's right. It can't be that.
Yeah,
that's
you're right.
Oh
on
my
gosh. I'm at 2,200.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, here I got a couple of questions for you. Now, I'm curious about autonomous vehicles, but this is a text message. So I put up a little note, said Chris Dorrington's going to be on the program today, and got this ahead of the show. So it's somebody who's paying attention and wants to know about Highway 7 South. This is from Baker to Ekalak. And we've gotten this question over the past few years, too. It was supposed to be redone, but there's still some areas there, not all the way to Ekalak. And so according to the text message here, some of the white line is broken from the pavement. Also, then there's a question here, too. And I was on this road, Highway 24 from Flowing Wells to the spillway on Fort Peck. That's going to be on the east side of Fort Peck heading north from 200, which is getting a lot of projects and getting a lot of redone as well. So there, that roadway is kind of a forgotten roadway, but it gets a lot of recreational pressure in the summertime as well. And so that texter is wondering about that. But let's go to Highway 7 south from Baker to Ekalak first.
Sure. So the first thing is obviously that the highways around Montana are hit and hammered hard. There's no one more important than the other than maybe the interstate and maybe some higher traveled routes. But Montana 7 is an important one. We do have a project. I was looking, I was trying to find, honestly, right now, just trying to find when that project is scheduled for. I know we have a project in the next 2 years. For that section of highway, and there is an improvement there on at least one or two of the timber structures, as I'd referenced earlier, in addition to the roadway.
Oh, okay.
So, your caller or texter is dead on. It's a narrow stretch of highway. The white line, which we call the fog line, that is right on the edge of dirt. And that's not uncommon across some of the highways in that category. That's called the primary network of highways, which is a section of highways that's both important but also on the lower level of the priority list just because there's only so many dollars to go around. But there is a project coming, and certainly Shane Mintz is the district administrator out there, and boy, Shane knows all about that road. He works with the locals and our stakeholders, our partners out in that area in order to get that prioritized and move forward.
You know, and I'm going to give a shout out because in the years that I've done this job and other jobs, when I'm talking with the local highway, the district manager or whatever the title is, they are tuned in, they are informed, and they know their roadways and the good and the bad about them like the back of their hands.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's, you know, they're in a tough position because they have stakeholders and communities. In the case of District 4, we go north south from Wyoming all the way up to Canada and from north and south Dakota border into and almost over to that Billings area. So it's the largest district that has the most lane miles of any district. And boy, that is a tough area to keep up on.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like you say, we get hit. I've been on the I've been up in Canada last year doing a little fishing, and the roadways up there are in rough shape. But
that's right.
Yeah, but they have that permafrost, and they have those conditions that we kind of deal with here as well, a little more magnified up there. So they do take a pounding. I'm going to talk about roadways maybe and innovation down the road. Let's finish up this other part of this question here, too. The recreational pressure on our highways has expanded over the past number of years. I mean, how do you, can you see that? Can you measure that? I don't know if there's a dollar and cents figure behind that, but the question here about some of these roadways to some of these recreational areas are in need of some help.
Yeah, absolutely. We can watch that just in. So we have traffic monitoring. If people have probably driven over the double hose crossing the highway in the summer, that what that's doing is both counting and categorizing the type of vehicles. You think about semi truck all the way down to now the 6 or 7 axle dump trucks down to heavy. F-250, F-350, or a passenger vehicle, we can tell how many of what type are going over that those hoses. And then we have some infrastructure in the roadway that also does the same thing. But on those vehicle counts and then the type, we know about how much about how much damage is anticipated as a result of that amount of traffic and the type of traffic. And then if we project that forward, we can definitely say this roadway is getting hammered today, but it's certainly going to get even more pressure in the future. And so we watch that pretty closely.
That's good. And can you, I suppose you're, that helps you in determining what priorities to fund. Let's take this call with Skip listening in Hamilton. There has been a little bit of a hubbub about the Bell Crossing roundabout. Skip, good morning. You're on the air here with Chris Dorrington, our director of the DOT.
And thank you, Tom. And good morning, Chris. And thanks for coming on. As soon as I heard you, I'm thinking, oh, I've got to ask this man what we're in for, so we can be more prepared. That's going to be a major project at some point in time, that Bell Crossing roundabout, and everything around that corner, all four of those corners are starting to build up. And could you please give us some information on, I think you know where the area is, on 93.
I do.
It gets major traffic in the morning and in the evening especially, and then a cutoff for people to go over to the east side of the valley when they're coming south, and vice versa when they're coming north to go to Stevensville across that Bell Crossing Bridge. But, sir, can you give us a timeline? And then also, if there's something we should know about the time of year especially, and any logistical things you can give us an idea about so that we can be mentally prepared for that. And whatever you can think of, I'm sure you'll cover the bases. And I, we have a, in, when it comes to emergency services, I just want you to know, in Ravalli County here, we have an amazing emergency services group of people that cover so many things, and they have their thumbs on the pulse of all the things that can go wrong in this valley, including we have labs here that we have to even be careful if there's a leak. These guys got their, they just know what to do.
Thanks.
Meanwhile,
thanks.
I just want you to know those things, and have a wonderful Christmas, and thank you ahead of time for your explanation.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Skip, I appreciate that.
Skip, thank you for the question. Obviously, that roundabouts are definitely a difficult subject in some communities, not all. Some people really actually appreciate them. But what we first do in the case of an intersection is just look at what's going on. And in the case of that, the county commission had asked us to take a good hard look at the Bell Crossing intersection. Initial indications were that a roundabout would be the safest alternative, not the cheapest, but definitely the safest alternative, because what it does is slow folks down and move people through at a safer passage rate. You're right. We've seen that access to that U.S. 93 corridor at Bell Crossing from both the east and west, there's quite a bit of traffic there, and that what that requires when you're accessing a U.S. highway is fast acceleration or fast deceleration, and then turning movements can be scary for people, which results in some crash trends that we're not very excited about. We want people to be safe out there. So the project there, we had paused as a result of some of the feedback from the local communities. We had made some interim improvements, including removing some signs so the people approaching the intersection can see traffic going both directions on US 93 before they make a decision to pull out or not. And then also reduce some speed through there. I think we've seen some improvement in the crash trends as a result of the interim measures. So we'll probably let that set for just a little bit so that we know when we go back to the drawing table to make an intersection improvement that we have done all of our due diligence in the interim steps first.
Thank you for that, Chris. And Skip, thanks for the question, too. And I appreciate you knowing, you know, these highways as well as you do. I love traveling Montana. So visiting those places, it's fun. And I, again, impressed that you know about these things. I'm running you out of time, so I appreciate your your time here. Can you give us a little bit about autonomous vehicles? Got a couple of minutes here is all. And then smart highways. What's innovative out there that has got you, you know, kind of looking at the future?
There are two sides of that coin, Tom, and I'd probably just, you know, point to the own dash on your car and what it can tell you. It can tell you if you're departing a lane. It can tell you if someone is stopping abruptly in front of you, or if you look at your mirror and it tells you somebody's in your blind spot. The cars are getting more and more intelligent. And one of the features that's interesting, newer cars will tell you what the speed limit is in the area you're traveling. That's really helpful. And then the roadway is getting smarter too. The vehicles and the roadway both. And there is technology coming in which the car will interact more and more with the roadway to understand both where the vehicle is and then rate of speed and some of the probably weather features that are out there. If you think I have a vehicle that tells me if it's potentially going to be icy just based on temperature alone. So the vehicles are coming that are going to be more and more automated. For some, that's a scary adventure, and I think technology companies are really working hard to be safe first. There was an interesting event just 2 or 3 days ago in San Francisco that the atmospheric river hit them as well, mm-hmm. wiped out a bunch of power in the area, and the traffic signal stopped. And so the Waymo vehicles in San Francisco also stopped because they couldn't orient themselves and then safely get people through an intersection. So the vehicle pulled over. It's the safest measure for those riders inside. But that's something for technology to really have to figure out. We have a great company in Montana named Aurora. They're working on autonomous commercial vehicles. Pretty interesting that they're in Montana and working hard on the impact of those vehicles on our infrastructure and how to safely move them through and to destinations in and beyond the state.
You know, good stuff, Chris. We're going to have to catch up again in the early part of the new year, and I know how busy you are. Thank you for your time here and downloading a bunch of stuff that we all live with every day and need to know more about. Happy holidays to you and your family. Chris.
Same, Tom.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Appreciate that.
Be safe, brother. Yeah. Have a great holiday season and be safe.
We look forward to seeing you in the new year. We're going to be up there in Helena in the early part of January. Chris Dorrington, again, our excellent Department of Montana Transportation Director.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.